The downing of a Ukrainian passenger plane over Tehran this week is haunting for one woman whose son died in a similar disaster 5 years ago.
It's the same situation. They shouldn't have flown because they were flying over conflict zone. They should have known in Ukraine, of all countries.
I'm Carol Hills. Haiti is marking a decade since an earthquake devastated the Caribbean nation. People are still fighting to recover.
What we are seeing 10 years later is that nothing is being done.
And later this hour, author Teju Cole takes us on a musical journey through Mali.
It is ancient, majestic, but it is also utterly contemporary.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. Iran has invited international investigators to help figure out what happened to Ukrainian International Airlines Flight 752. All 176 people on board died early Wednesday when the plane came down, just a couple minutes after it took off from Tehran Airport. That was the night Iran was on alert for possible U.S. air raids. The U.S., Canada, and Britain all say they have intelligence that the plane was shot down. Tehran strenuously denies that. And while Iran appears to be cooperating with the international community on the investigation, reports from Tehran say the crash site has been bulldozed. Attention is now focused on other forms of evidence, including a cell phone video. In it, a dog barks after a bright flash in the night sky. It's 10 seconds later when this sound arrives. It's chilling. The video's authenticity was verified by the New York Times and analyzed by the investigative journalism group Bellingcat. Bellingcat specializes in this kind of work using open source material. Eric Toller is their head of Eastern Europe and Eurasia research.
So this video shows a night sky with a missile, presumably a missile, some kind of airborne object, moving west towards east and then striking another object, and then a big explosion. But if you look at this video, at first glance, it looks like it's impossible to locate. You know, there's some, you know, kind of depressing-looking apartment buildings. There's a construction site and apparently, like, a water septic tank. So just looking at this, you think, like, you know, how in the world can you figure out where this was? But this is what we do all the time, all day, every day. And so we were kind of looking around some suburbs west of Tehran, kind of near the flight path. And after a while, we found a perfect match for the location of this video. The apartment buildings lined up perfectly. We found a construction site. And we were able to say with pretty good certainty that the video was filmed in an exact neighborhood in a western Tehran suburb. And this morning, some other people went to the same site and took kind of photos, kind of recreating the perspective, and it did match up.
So when you see the video, there's this interval between the time you see the flash and hear the blast. What did that interval of time tell you?
Well, it's just like if you're watching a thunderstorm, right? So you see lightning, and then you kind of count the seconds, and you hear the thunder. Well, it's the same principle with, you know, explosions of airplanes in the sky. Obviously, everyone knows the speed of light is a whole lot faster than the speed of sound. So we were able to figure out that this explosion was around 3 or so kilometers away from the camera, based off the time that it took for the sound to reach the person holding the camera.
So if it is authentic, what does this video tell us?
Well, it tells us that, you know, assuming we can make the logical leap that the object that blew up in the exact flight path is the same as Ukraine International flight, then we can say that it was almost certainly a missile or another kind of projectile hitting the plane and exploding on the same flight path as the plane. This one video doesn't tell us, you know, definitely bank your life on it, that's what happened. But I'd probably put my 401k and my life savings in the saying that it was. So, again, this is one 15-second video. It doesn't tell us, you know, everything, and you can't, you know, take Iran to court just based on this one thing. But with all the other forensic evidence, with the debris and the crash site, and I'm sure that there's some intelligence stuff that'll come out eventually, and there's other videos as well. This is just one video. There's two or three other ones floating around as well that haven't been verified to the same degree as this one. Once all this is taken in sum, then it looks like the story is going to be that it was an accidental shootdown from an Iranian anti-aircraft missile system.
Now, Iran today again rejected the suggestion that the plane was shot down. This is Iran's civil aviation chief, Ali Abedzadeh, speaking at a news conference in Tehran earlier today. He says, we can say with certainty that this plane was not hit by a missile, that the plane was on fire in the air for more than a minute and a half. And he said the location shows that the pilot was attempting to return to the airport. Eric Toller, you're with Bellingcat. How certain are you of what happened?
Well, I mean, from the available evidence, there's something that flew up and hit this plane right before the crash. It doesn't take a huge logical leap to say this was a missile. But that's a good point raised about the plane turning back towards the airport, because apparently this did happen, because the flight of the crash debris is in a location further east than trajectory. And it does seem like the plane was actually banking east, kind of turning around back towards the airport. The working theory that we and many other people have is it's likely that there were two missiles launched from an anti-aircraft missile system. They usually fire two missiles. One hits, and then there's a pause, and there's a second one. And this is consistent with what the videographer told the New York Times, that he heard a loud shot, and then he took out his phone, started recording, and then they saw the second one, which is the one that we see from the video. And this would make sense because they were hit, the plane was hit, and then the pilot started turning to return to the airport, and then the second impact happened afterwards. So what the Iranian official is saying is not completely contradicting the theory that there was a missile strike, because there was some action from the pilot to turn the plane.
Eric Toler of Bellingcat, thanks a lot.
Sure, thank you.
For many families, knowing what happened and why could help bring closure. It would for Selena Fredericks. She lost her son Bryce in the Malaysia Airlines disaster in 2014. Russian-backed separatists shot down the passenger plane as it flew over eastern Ukraine. More than 290 passengers and crew died. Selena told me about her experience last summer when international investigators charged three Russians and one Ukrainian with murder in connection with the MH17 catastrophe. She's still waiting for the trial to start in a couple months. I reached out to her again today to see how she's doing. Is this Selena?
Yes, yeah, speaking.
Hi.
Yeah, my granddaughter is crying.
Oh. Selena told me that the UIA plane crash brings up the same emotions she felt after the MH17 crash.
It hurts to see what happened again. We hoped that it would never happen again, but still it did.
It sounds like for you, what you're saying is it was never a question of if this would happen again,
yes,
but when. Why is that? What have you been crossing around your mind?
Because nothing changed. Airliners are still flying over conflict zones, over war zones. Airspaces are not closed when they should be. It's all about money.
You think it's all about the airlines trying to find the shortest routes? You told me when we spoke last summer that, in your case, Malaysia Airlines should take responsibility for the 2014 disaster because it flew over a known conflict zone. What responsibility do you think, in this case, Ukrainian International Airlines should be taking for having a flight take off from Tehran's airport on Wednesday?
It's the same situation. They shouldn't have flown because they were flying over conflict zone. They should have known in Ukraine. Of all countries.
Iranian officials are denying any responsibility for the Ukrainian plane crash. Does it remind you of the Russian government's denial of its involvement in the downing of MH17?
It's the same story all over again.
I know it's been incredibly difficult for you, and it happened in 2014, the loss of your son and his girlfriend. It's just something that really never ends. But in the case of the MH17 tragedy, are you still looking to get more information, to get more candor from Russia, to get to find out things you want to find out?
Yes. For us, the most important thing is the truth. What happened and why could it happen? Russia is not cooperating, only lying. That makes it very, very difficult for us. In March, the trial will start and we hope to get more answers.
Will you be at the trial?
Yes. I will be there every day.
I can't imagine what it's been like for you and families like yours, Selena, and how you continue to cope. But I wonder what advice you can give the families who had loved ones on the Ukrainian flight and are just entering this kind of nightmare.
It's very difficult. Take it day by day. Don't look too far forward. It's very difficult. In the beginning, I said, you have to keep breathing. That's all. And we feel again what those families feel now. It brings it all back. We grieve with them. It's horrible. Again.
Selena Fredericks lost her son Bryce to the Malaysia Airlines tragedy in 2014. She's been speaking with us about the Ukrainian commercial airline that crashed in Iran this week, killing all 176 passengers and crew on board. Selena, I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts with us today. I know it's hard, and I want to wish the best of luck to you.
You're very welcome, and I wish to families very much love and strength.
And I want you to go back to your wonderful grandchild right now and
Thank
have some
you.
Fun. Iraq's most respected Shia Muslim cleric says no foreign power should be allowed to decide the fate of Iraq. The Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani delivered that message today during Friday prayers through his spokesman Ahmad al-Safi.
إِنَّمَا وَقَعَ فِي الْأَيَّامِ الْأَخِيرَةِ مِنْ اَعْتِدَاءَاتٍ خَطِيرَةٍ
The Ayatollah said both Iranian and U.S. attacks in Iraq violate the country's sovereignty. There have been protests in Iraq for months, protests against Iranian interference and also against Iraqi government corruption. In response, Iraqi security forces, with the help of pro-Iran militias, have shot dead hundreds of Iraqi people and locked up thousands more. But that violent crackdown has not deterred the protesters. From Baghdad's Tahrir Square, here's the BBC's Jeremy Bowen.
There's a heavy concrete wall blocking off what was once one of the city's main roads, a line of policemen, barbed wire, a checkpoint, and then the area controlled by the demonstrators, the protesters, begins. The policeman at the gate here said, be careful when you pass us because there's no government, it's a different country. In fact, it's the center of Baghdad.
Baghdad, Bahra.
Baghdad, hurrah, hurrah.
Baghdad, hurrah, hurrah.
You're saying Baghdad, freedom. The protests started here back in October, particularly the first couple of months. The authorities and the militias reacted very violently. A lot of people shot dead, badly injured, tear gas canisters as well. Terrible, terrible injuries. You support the revolution?
Yeah, yeah. Because we are suffer a lot of things. There's a lot of people who's hungry.
One thing that really strikes me here is just how young these guys are who are at the forefront of it.
Hello, how are you?
What's your name?
My name is Ali.
Ali, tell me why you're here, Ali.
To
ask about our rights, the simplest rights as Iraqis, water, electricity, job.
A lot of people have been killed here, shot dead. You must be worried about your safety.
That's why we are here. Because of martyrs' blood here, we will not leave.
Walking around this place, normally a great big traffic circle with protesters, Greek food, political posters. I'm taken back to 2011, another Tahrir Square in Cairo during the Egyptian uprising against Hosni Mubarak. That was a time of high hopes. It didn't end well for them. Here, I think they realize much more graphically what they're up against. And in Egypt, it was, in a way, a local quarrel. Here, there's foreign interference. And what the protesters here are mostly wary about are the pro-Iranian militias, because the people here are fed up with Iran and they want them out. This is a place of demonstrations. There's a small march going by now. They're giving out leaflets, the demos, because a man called Mohammed Fadl al-Aboudi was kidnapped. It says kidnappings and intimidation will not deter the uprisings. Stop assassinations, kidnapping, and the killing of Iraqi activists. What a lot of people here say is the protesters get targeted, followed home, and then taken. Many protesters blame Iran for interfering to control and protect corrupt Iraqi governments. Some say that in the last months before he was assassinated here in Baghdad a week ago, the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani told the Iraqis to open fire to stop the protests. Hundreds have been killed. Now the protesters are also blaming the Americans for increasing the chances of war in Iraq. They want foreigners to just leave them alone.
The BBC's Jeremy Bowen in Baghdad. 10 years ago this weekend, on January 12, 2010, a massive 7.0 earthquake rocked Haiti, just outside the capital of Port-au-Prince. More than 300,000 people died. Another 1.5 million people were injured. Hundreds of thousands more were displaced. Valina Charlier was 29 years old at the time. She lost many friends. In the years since, Valina has become an anti-corruption activist. Valina, Take us back 10 years ago to the earthquake. I wonder, how vivid are those memories for you still?
They're still very vivid. It's memories that you live with every day. 10 years ago when the earthquake happened, I was at home. And my baby was 28 days old at the time, my firstborn. And everything started falling down, you know, glasses breaking and chaos started.
How were your friends and extended family impacted by the earthquake?
I lost a lot of friends at Caribbean Supermarket because Caribbean Supermarket was leveled all the way to the ground. But the one that really hurt most is my cousin passing away. Mm-hmm. And he passed at his house. He was very young, fresh out of college. It was his first day at his new job. Mm-hmm. And we all think that he probably made it home and then went to lay on his bed and rest. And the earthquake happened.
So sorry.
Oh. But next to that, it was also seeing how many lives and dreams were destroyed in a couple of seconds.
I know at the time of the earthquake 10 years ago, you were working for a cellular company, and that took you around Haiti after the quake to kind of help rebuild the cellular stores and help get the country going again. What did you witness after the quake as you traveled around Haiti?
Chaos. It's not only buildings that had collapsed and people who had died, but there was also a lot of hopelessness because things that you would see every day. Mom no longer talking, only looking at picture, or kids completely lost, small yeah. children because they lost their entire family, so not really knowing where to go, what to do. But although there was lots of sadness, there was also a lot of hope because there were so many people coming in. They would be rebuilding and rebuilding better.
It's been 10 years since the quake. I know a lot has changed in Haiti since then, but how does today's situation compare?
I don't really like to compare the earthquake with today, and I'm going to explain why. The earthquake was a natural disaster, was a drama, something that nobody could have predicted. While what we are seeing 10 years later is that nothing's been done from what we as human beings could have done to prevent that much damage from happening if ever there was an earthquake. Nothing has been rebuilt. We still have 10 years later tent cities. We still have people living in tent cities, and these people have been forgotten. Nobody's thinking about them. 10 years later, we're in a situation where there's a humanitarian crisis in Haiti. There's close to half of the population who's living with less than $5 a day, and even more than that are living with no food. And all the dreams that I had at the time, I feel that today they're all broken promises.
10 years ago, at the time of the earthquake, you were 29, you had a newborn. Today, in 2020, 10 years on, where do you find hope?
Funny enough, 10 years later, I'm pregnant with my third girl. So I find hope in my people. I believe in Haiti. I believe in Haitians. I believe that my wellness, me being good and feeling good about myself, also means that other people around me are feeling good. I believe that human beings should be allowed to live like decent human beings. So this is where I find all of my hope, and this is where I find the resilience to continue fighting in Haiti to impact lives.
Vilina Charlier is an activist in Haiti. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
10 years ago, billions of dollars was pledged from the international community to help rebuild Haiti. So what happened to all that money? Jeanne Sedke has spent the last decade co-leading a UN Special Advisor's Office on community-based health and aid delivery to Haiti. Jeanne, we just heard that nothing has really been rebuilt in Haiti. What went wrong?
Well, that's a good question. I think we need to start with good intentions. So a lot of money was pledged, probably not enough. But we had about $10 billion that was promised to Haiti from governments, plus another $3 billion that was donated to private NGOs. So you're talking at least $13 billion. And what went wrong? From our analysis, what went wrong is very little of that money actually stayed in Haiti.
Where did it go?
It essentially stayed in the capitals of the donor countries. And let me explain that. The way this works is that donors, when they contribute funding to a particular country, they mostly give to their own NGOs. So while the money is for a particular country, in our analysis of aid to Haiti, of the $6.4 billion that eventually was what we call dispersed, which means money out of the bank, only 10% of that stayed in Haiti, meaning was used to hire locally, create jobs, support the government, pay salaries. The rest of the funding essentially never got to Haiti. That money is not used to build, for example, a ministry of health, a ministry of education, all the things that for you and me that are essential, things that we know are necessary to thrive, don't exist in Haiti necessarily because they're too weak, because no donor has invested in creating that, building that, strengthening that.
How easy has it been to track where the money went, all that money, that $10 billion that was pledged for Haiti?
It was hard. I mean, what we learned is that there is no system in place to track money that has been pledged to a poor country after a crisis. That does not exist. Our office was the only one doing it and still is. And my sense is, and not, I don't want to be cynical, but my sense is there's no interest in doing so. What's really needed is to reimagine how aid is delivered.
Jan Sedke spent the last decade co-leading a UN Special Advisor's Office about community health and aid in Haiti. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You see a tragedy and you think, what can I do? Or in the case of the Australian wildfires, what can I sew? Sewers and knitters with kind hearts and quick hands are whipping up comfy fabric pouches for baby animals who've been orphaned by the bushfires.
So these little pouches just give the babies that the carers are working with and trying to save a similar sort of environment, I guess, to their mum.
Chris Perkinson and her daughter are sewing wraps for baby bats and pouches for kangaroo joeys. The Australian group Animal Research Craft Guild has published very specific instructions on what to make and exactly where to mail the pouches, wraps, and hanging slings. They're also providing the sewing patterns. And as with any disaster effort, cash donations are also requested. This week has left many regular flyers wondering, how do airlines decide where they should and shouldn't fly?
Flying over the Middle East isn't easy. You've got a lot of places to avoid. You don't really want to be over Syria either. And when you combine Syria, Iran, and Iraq, that's a big piece of real estate.
I'm Carol Hills. That's next on The World. Returning to our top story, the Ukraine International Airlines crash in Iran. Since the crash, a number of airliners announced they're canceling or rerouting flights that use airspace over Iran and Iraq. But you may be surprised that commercial airlines would be flying over a conflict zone in the first place. We talked to Keith Mackey, the president of Mackey International, an airline safety consulting firm. He told us this is actually pretty common.
Each country has sovereign airspace above it, which it controls. Additionally, each country controls aircraft registered within that country, and they can restrict where those aircraft can fly. Now, as an example, just prior to the Ukrainian airline crash in Iran, the U.S. closed all airspace for U.S. registered airline flights or U.S. registered pilots to fly over Iraq, Iran, the Persian Gulf, and the Gulf of Oman.
Just to be clear, what you're saying is that certain countries had told their commercial airliners, you can't fly over Iraq, Iran, these other places, but other countries hadn't given those same warnings.
That's correct. The airline has the ultimate authority, even if they're permitted to fly over a country, to decide whether they want to do it or whether they don't want to take that risk. Now, a great example of this is the Malaysian Flight 17 that was going from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur in July of 2014. And the airline elected to take the shortest route, which brought it over Crimea. And at the time, the separatists were having a war, and they thought it was an incoming missile or something and shot it down.
And that, of course, that tragic flight, that's the most recent horrible event that's possibly very similar to what happened in Iran. What's in it for airlines to continue to fly over war zones or conflict areas? Is it just about the cost of getting somewhere quicker and expending less fuel?
Basically, yes, but it's also a matter of being able to have the departure and the destination within range of their equipment and to provide reasonable flight times, I suppose. If you had to fly airline A and it was going to take 4 hours to get there, but you could ride on airline B and it would only take 2 hours, and you weren't aware that the reason for the change was because you were going to be flying over a conflict zone. So there again, it's the choice of the route for the airline as to how they wish to go. Flying over the Middle East isn't easy. You've got a lot of places to avoid. You don't really want to be over Syria either. And when you combine Syria, Iran, and Iraq, that's a big piece of real estate. So it becomes difficult for passengers to realize those sort of things.
If you're a passenger on a long-haul flight from, you know, London to India, can you check your flight's routing to see if it's going over a conflict zone?
Not normally. The crew, usually when they do their announcements, they'll describe the route that you're taking. But by that time, you're already at 35,000 feet, so it isn't going to help very much to change your mind.
Around this current tragedy in Iran, do you think anything will change after this crash? I mean, in many ways, it seems really close on the heels of the Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. I mean, what needs to change to prevent these things from happening again?
Well, there again, preventing commercial flights from flying through war zones or zones of conflict where there's a possibility of a firefight taking place.
Keith Mackey is the president of Mackey International, an airline safety consulting firm. Thanks a lot, Keith.
Carol, you're very welcome.
Locust swarms are spreading across the Horn of Africa, creating the worst locust outbreak in 25 years in the region. The swarms originated in the Middle East and have been moving towards Africa for over a year. In the past month, thick clouds of locusts have devastated farmland in Ethiopia and Somalia, and they've now spread to Kenya. Neighboring countries are on high alert. A season of heavy rains and flooding have made the locust problem even worse. Mahari Tesfoyohannes is with the Desert Locust Control Organization in Nairobi, Kenya.
I had a lot of experience in this locust for the last 30 years. I didn't see such kind of infestation in my life. It is so heavy.
He says farmers are trying to chase away the locusts without much success. Keith Cressman is a locust expert with the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Keith, can you describe the impact of the locust swarms happening now? I mean, what does it look like on the ground after they've come through?
What we're dealing with now are what we call the immature stage of the desert locust. This is the most voracious. They're young adults, so you can imagine they're kind of like your teenagers at home. They eat an awful lot of food. When they come into, let's say, a farmer's field, and this will be a farmer who's growing crops, subsistence crops, if a swarm comes in during the morning, by the end of that morning, there'll be nothing left in the field for that farmer. And you have to think that this farmer's field, that is her or his livelihood for the entire year. And if it's a good year of rainfall like we have this year, then it's probably also kind of security production for several years to come. Also, locusts are attacking pastures. And in the Horn of Africa, pasture lands are extremely important.
These locusts, are they like the ones we hear in the summer in the U.S.? You know, in a hot summer, you hear the... Is the same thing or is it different?
No, it's a very different thing. What you hear in the hot summer that make a lot of noise... These are cicadas. The locusts that are in Africa, in the Horn of Africa, these are the ones that have been written about in the Bible, in the Quran. So they've been around an awful long time. They're survivors.
What is the impact of this current locust outbreak on food security in Eastern Africa? Because it sounds like they're just devouring a lot of stuff.
You have to realize that food security in this part of Africa, in the Horn of Africa, it's extremely vulnerable. You know, any small disruption to their kind of very fragile balance can be extremely devastating to not only food security, but to livelihoods in general.
Is there anything farmers or governments can do to combat the swarms of locusts?
Locust control is in the hand of governments because of the scale and the size of the problem. This is done basically by having a fleet of crop dusters in the areas that are spraying the locusts.
What's the outlook going forward? How long is this locust infestation likely to last?
I would say that the outlook is not good. With each generation, the locust numbers increase 20 times.
Oh,
so after 6 months, that means you have nearly 500 times the locusts that you have now. The swarms are already extremely large. They're in areas that are vast, remote, and often insecure. And now they're getting into countries that haven't seen swarms for decades. So their capacity to respond, you know, quickly and effectively is rather limited.
Keith Cressman is with the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Thanks a lot, Keith.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
When the locusts swarm, their sandy-colored bodies fill the air around you. We have a video of what these farmers in Kenya are facing. It's on our Instagram. We're at PRI The World. Last month, France announced that it would return 26 pieces of art to the West African country of Benin. The pieces were looted by French soldiers more than 100 years ago. This isn't just a story about France. It's about European countries and their relationships with African nations that they used to colonize. The World's Halima Gikandi reports.
Alain Godinot is the director of museums in Benin. He grew up in the coastal city of Porto Novo, the capital of the country. Art and culture runs in his family.
And my grandfather was a very famous artist, singer too, traditional singer. So in my family, my old family, we used to be very linked to tradition.
Benin has a rich cultural history. It's where the kingdom of Dahomey thrived for hundreds of years. The kingdom's art is known for large wooden sculptures, thrones, and elaborate metal swords. But to Godinot, the most important piece of art isn't any of these. It's a small necklace made out of glass beads. It belonged to a fierce female warrior who once defended the kingdom in the late 1800s. Those warriors are often called Amazons.
These Amazons had necklace, a very beautiful necklace, very expensive one. If you look, you go through the materials, it's a handmade work. So that means that the women, they are not women fighting like men. They are women fighting like women.
Godinot says the fact that the Amazons wore such expensive jewelry shows how important they were. He first saw the necklace more than 15 years ago, but not in Benin. As far as he knows, there's no artwork from the Amazons on display in the country. Instead, the necklace sits in a case hundreds of miles away in France.
Because it was the first object the French colonial army just have taken. It was the first thing they bring back. They bring it back because they were very surprised to see women.
The necklace is one of countless objects that were taken by France when colonial soldiers waged a war against the kingdom in 1892. That artwork was never returned. Dahomey became an independent country in 1960, and in 1975 it was renamed the People's Republic of Benin. Since independence, Benin, like many African countries, has made multiple efforts to reclaim stolen objects, but with little success. But Godinot is hoping that might change.
Je veux que d'ici 5 ans, les conditions soient réunies.
French President Emmanuel Macron has made this a priority. In 2018, he commissioned a report that shocked the art world. It called for an immediate return of African works of art taken during the colonial era. Some experts reckon that 90% of African art remains outside of Africa. Céline Fremont, who teaches West African art at Yale, says the issue of returning African art goes well beyond France.
What is at stake in the debate is the redefinition of the relationship between African countries and European countries past the moment of decolonization.
European museums and cultural institutions are starting to reevaluate some of the African art in their collections. Macron's call to return African art has brought criticism. Some say it was a political move. Some art experts argue that African countries don't have the proper infrastructure to preserve certain works of art. But when it comes to art restitution, there is a key difference between the U.S. and Europe. Most American museums are private, which means it's up to the museums to decide whether or not to return artwork. In France and other parts of Europe, many museums are public institutions, which means restitution is a decision for the government to make. Asmina Jassani is an American art lawyer based in London.
For example, in France, France's patrimonial code defines, you know, anything in the public museums there as inalienable. And French museums have classified every object that's entered into their inventory as important cultural heritage. So as a result, France will need to pass new legislation allowing for artifacts to be deaccessioned from national collections each time it wants to restitute something.
Godonneau, the museum director in Benin, hopes that eventually all works of art looted by French soldiers will be returned to Benin. But he says that the decision to return the 26 objects is an important first step.
So it's very important for people, for youth, to see that in the past, in their history, their ancestors used to do so well. It's a part of their identity.
Godonneau is involved in the negotiations with France, which are still ongoing. But the original list of 26 pieces didn't include the object that Godonneau believes is most important. That's the Amazon necklace, the kind worn by female warriors who fought the French.
These women have been killed for their country. So it is a small object, but full of symbol for me.
Benin has formally requested that France include the necklace. Godonneau is still hopeful that it will come back home later this year, just in time for the country to celebrate Benin's 60th anniversary of independence from France. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
A campaign rally in Taipei had supporters cheering for the re-election of Taiwan's first female president, Tsai Ing-wen. Taiwan is self-governing, but China claims the island as its territory. So when Taiwan voters go to the polls tomorrow, China will be top of mind, especially after what happened in Hong Kong.
The lesson we learned from Hong Kong, if we don't insist, we'll be losing everything we have now.
That's President Tsai speaking to the BBC at one of her campaign rallies this week.
This is absolutely no political game here. It's a real threat. China is here everywhere, and its influence is here as well.
Beijing has been stepping up military, political, and economic pressure on Taiwan. That, plus the turmoil in Hong Kong and China's policies against Muslim Uyghurs, have many Taiwanese people worried. Tsai's party supports Taiwan's formal independence from China. Before Hong Kong flared up, Tsai's main opponent, Hong Kuo-yu, had been the front runner in the presidential race. He argues that Taiwan's economy is too reliant on the mainland to cut ties. Han says China is Taiwan's biggest trading partner, and Tsai's approach threatens the island's stability and prosperity. The choice before voters in tomorrow's presidential election could represent an important turning point in China-Taiwan relations. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're going to take you to a place right now where the nightlife is all about live music. Bamako, the capital of Mali in West Africa. Music in Mali is rooted in a deep and revered history of troubadours and storytelling, but with a modern beat. For Teju Cole, getting to Mali and immersing himself in its music scene was a lifelong dream. Cole is an author, critic, and photographer from Kalamazoo, Michigan. But he spent most of his childhood in Lagos, Nigeria, where his parents are from. He's finally made his dream of getting to Mali a reality with a music-fueled visit. The World's Marco Werman caught up with Teju Cole to dish about music and life in West Africa.
I got to ask you first, Teju, how hard was it to come home?
It was pretty tough to come home. You know, I wasn't in Mali for very long, but mentally I've been in Mali for such a long time. I think I first discovered the music of Mali in 1992, I think, when I came to the U.S., and I started listening to music by Ali Farka Touré. And ever since then, you know, it just never let me go. There was something about Mali that was both a strong reminder of the fact that, you know, I was this kid who had grown up in Africa, And now in the U.S., anything African reminded me of home. But also the sensation that Mali's music was different from Nigerian music. It was strange. It was otherworldly. My heart got bound to it in a certain way. So when the opportunity came finally to go to Mali, I was as excited as I've ever been for any journey I've taken in the dozens of countries I've ended up visiting.
Well, we've been talking music, Teju. Let's listen to some music. You've put together a playlist based on your trip. It's called In Bamako. We'll link to it at theworld.org. And I spent some bright moments with the music on this playlist. I want to start with one track that jumped out at me for a number of reasons. This is Bako Daniel's song, Donsoke, released in 2007. Donsoke! What a commanding voice. So Bako Daniel, she's no longer with us, but she was known as a griot. She was born into this world of singing and performance and poetry in Mali. You see this concept of djelia with a singer like Bako Daniel, Teju Cole. What is djelia, and how is musical talent the domain of certain families and passed down in those families in Mali?
Yes, in Mali, there is a strong and ancient practice of having certain families be the musical families. And it's not just music, it's that particular skills of voice, of instrumentation, are passed down along particular family lines.
Well, Bako Daniel, she's not alive, but you saw her daughter perform in Bamako. So this lineage is by no means theoretical.
I mean, it was jaw-dropping for me. Bako Daniel's music was something I very much loved. And I walked into this space, I saw this incredible young singer. I don't know how old she was, I think maybe in her late 20s. And it turned out to be Bako Daniel's daughter. And this is not just a young lady with talent who followed what her mother had done. This was somebody who was taught from the time she was very young to sing, not just vocal quality, but to know the stories, to know the kind of vocal performance that summons up the history of the people. And she sort of takes that all in as a familial and artistic responsibility. And this is everywhere in Malian music. Not every musician, there are notable exceptions, like Salif Keita, who decided to be a musician. Mm. But very, very many of the Malian musicians come from a lineage. And I think this ends up affecting the kind of spiritual power that the music has, because virtuosity is often combined with authority. Sometimes you experience an artist and you know that something is coming through them that is more than just their own experience of life.
Yeah, I know when Bako Daniel kind of like her voice kind of climbs up those octaves. I mean, when she's on the top, that's authority. That's where she's reaching. Let's listen to another song. This is Mansa by The Rail Band.
The lead guitarist there is a man called Jelimadi Tunkara. He is one of the great virtuosos in the world. He is a figure on the level of a Yo-Yo Ma, a figure on the level of an Eric Clapton, you know, of a Mitsuko Uchida. This is somebody whose mastery of his instrument is a guitar, has sort of left orbit. There's this incredible mythos inside the music, whether it's music of the epics or whether it's just their ordinary pop music. It's spacious and it's got a wonderful sense of itself.
Well, speaking of pop music, here's one more track from your playlist. This is Umu Sangare and Tony Allen. The song is called Yere Faga, and that's Umu Sangare, who's a legend in Mali, kind of borderline griot, and Tony Allen, one of your family's compatriots.
Teju Cole. He's a drummer and was Fela Kuti's drummer for many years. But this is a relatively recent recording from Umu Sangare and really kind of shakes up styles. Why'd you choose this track?
Because, you know, it's important when we love something not to confine it to our notions of how traditional it is or to put people in some kind of permanent past. Part of what excites me about the music of Mali is that it is ancient, majestic, but it is also utterly contemporary. It is alive to the world. It is aware of musical movements and trends. I want my relationship with Malian music to be ongoing. I don't want to be a chin-stroking nostalgist who thinks, oh, it was better in the 70s, because I don't think it was. I think this is a musical tradition robust enough to keep evolving, and I hope to keep giving me pleasure for as long as I'm alive.
Teju Cole, it is always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Marco, it's nice to talk to you again. Thank you for drawing me out on this great enthusiasm of mine.
It's my pleasure.
The World's Marco Werman, talking with Teju Cole. He's created a playlist for us inspired by his trip to Mali. Look for that at our website, theworld.org. That's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.